We begin our class at the very obvious place with a welcome back to everybody. I worked it out that it has been 28 weeks since we last met, and that's 196 days, which is over half a year. Now let's read Belgic Confession 36, paragraph 4, the last paragraph on page 75 of the Green Creeds book. Belgic Confession, Article 36, Paragraph 4. Wherefore, we detest the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people, and in general, all those who reject the higher powers and magistrates and would subvert justice, introduce a community of goods, and confound that decency and good order which God hath established among men. Tonight's subject is the community of goods. The community of goods. And by the community of goods, we mean common ownership of property, with all those involved having a common purse, with all their assets, as it were, being pooled, and even future income, so that in a group practicing community of goods, if, let's say, one member of that group gets the inheritance from their deceased uncle, then that goes into the common pot. Common ownership of property, community of goods or property. And then flowing from that is the equality of consumption. So the idea is you don't have everybody pooling their assets and then somebody else living like a lord and another person starving, but rather an equitable division of the goods for the consumption of the group, and it being understood ordinarily that everyone consumes frugally. The opposite of the community of goods is what? This group practices the community of goods, the other group holds to the principle of, on the other hand, the opposite, private property. So we have community of goods, and my notes, COG, which is also the abbreviation for the Covenant of Grace, and community of goods and the Covenant of Grace are very different, versus PP, private property. Now, why in classes on Christian theology are we dealing with a topic like community of goods? Because it's a political concept, it's an economic concept, and it is, as some of you may already have felt, somewhat more abstruse than the sorts of things we deal with here, typically. The answer is that these classes on Christian doctrine are following the Belgic Confession, and the Belgic Confession in Article 36, Paragraph 4, which we read earlier, mentions community of goods. We detest the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people who, amongst other things, introduce a community of goods. So the idea of the community of goods is a tenet of much of Anabaptism, as well as other groups. To state the need and value for studying the community of goods, more positively, we could say that looking at this will help us develop the Christian worldview. And the Christian worldview, including property, private property, as opposed to the community of goods, the Christian worldview is needed by adults and their children, so that we will think Christianly about the society in which we live and about private belongings. And I brought some copies, many of you will have seen it and even read it, of the Reformed Worldview on Behalf of a Godly Culture by Prof. Engelsma, which treats the main components of a Reformed worldview in at least outline. Brian?
Just to say that the Tyler Brethren in the Glengormley area practice community of goods.
Tyler Brethren in the Gormley area
They have practice. One person who goes to the butchers and buys all the meat for all of their families and distributes it.
Okay. So there's an instance of you living in around Glengarmley. We have it, a form of communism. So the Bible speaks to these issues, and it's important to get this community of goods, private property, etc., straight in a day in which even the building blocks of society are under attack, because there are more and more people, especially among those who believe themselves to be wise, who actually advocate the communion of goods. And many of them who do this don't want to scare people off and say, oh look, I'm a communist. They say, well, I'm a bit on the left, I'm a socialist, or I'm progressive or something. But as Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, as he once said, the goal of socialism is communism. At least it was certainly his goal to get into socialism and then to communism. Now, before we launch into this tenet of much of Anabaptism, communion or community of goods, we need to remind ourselves of the Anabaptist beliefs. Because in Belgic Confession 36, Guido de Bray and the Reformed community have as their chief target and foil the Anabaptists. These are Anabaptist belief both then, in the 16th century, and now, more or less. Now, the general major theological doctrines of Anabaptists are what? We're not now talking about Belgic Confession 36, but theologically, what do the Anabaptists in general believe?
Rebaptism, free will.
Okay, they're Baptists, obviously, Anabaptist rebaptizers. Julian says free will, Brian and then Sam.
I was going to say Arminians.
They're Arminian to the core. They were way more Arminius, and they are more Arminian than Arminius himself, if that's possible. No predestination, that's a terrible doctrine. Limited atonement, oh no, Christ died. God loves everybody, Christ died for everybody, grace is universal, God's trying the best he can and wanting to save everybody, but failing for the vast majority of them. Saints can be saved and then lost, and man has free will, therefore he's not totally depraved. The Anabaptists, and I haven't seen a single dissenter in their midst, deny justification by faith alone. They're actually more consistent than many Arminians. No justification by faith alone, and they were millennialist. And as a general characteristic, they weren't into theology. It was all practical, it was all good works, it was all, I'll give you my personal impression, very depressing. Very depressing. You read the Anabaptist stuff, and I just see moralism from cover to cover, and I think there's no depth here of exegesis. The shallowness of theology. That's somebody who's learned the Reformed faith. That's a general characteristic of the Anabaptists. Moralistic and do-goodism. Like, we believe in morals, Christian morals. We believe in doing good works. But there's moralism and do-goodism, and oh, it's depressing. Now, regarding Belgic Confession 36 on the magistrate, we saw that some Anabaptists, especially at the very start, believed in violent revolution. And in our opening three classes, we looked at two instances of this. Can anyone remember from over half a year ago what they are? The Munster Rebellion of 1534-35, a city in northwest of Germanic lands. And the other one is the Germans' peasants' revolt in southern Germany in 1524 to 35. And in part as a reaction to that, Anabaptism as a whole today is pacifistic, against all wars, and no Christian, from the Anabaptist perspective, could be a soldier, for instance. And then this widens out to a huge distrust, if not aversion, to the state, because the state is not part of the perfection of Christ, that vague, pious-sounding phrase, which means that no Anabaptist is allowed to work for the state. Courts, education, transport, law and order, very dodgy. It's sort of an unclean area per se. And this fits in with the whole idea of Anabaptist world flight, including a view of technology, cars, electricity, and so forth, and involved also is a rejection of oaths. You don't take an oath to the state or in a court of law where you shouldn't really be in there, and that your yea be yea, your nay nay, because there's a simple moralistic exegesis within Anabaptism. And so part of the general theology is its view regarding church, believer, and state. And now within that comes this whole issue of community of goods. So we began our treatment of Anabaptist political history and theory with three classes on the history and then four classes on their theory. And for proof of this, we read again paragraph 4 of Belgic Confession 36. Wherefore we detest the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people, and in general, all those who reject the higher powers and magistrates, which they do, and would subvert justice, and they do that in various ways I've already mentioned, introduce a community of goods, our particular focus now, and Lord willing next week, and confound that decency and good order which God hath established among men. And by the end of this class, you're going to see more and more, see what those words mean? Yeah, and begin to build up a picture. And in previous classes, I showed you a very famous early Anabaptist confession. Can anyone remember its name? The Schlietheim Confession, written in what's now northern Switzerland, very close to the German border. And here, front and back, if anyone hasn't gotten a copy of that and would like to read it, and if anybody else wants to take a copy to refresh their minds, here is the Schlietheim Confession. And of the seven articles treated, Article 4, separation from the abomination, Article 6, on the sword, and Article 7 on the oath are the ones which are most in connection with Belgic Confession 36, civil government issues. So you can refresh or renew your memory by reading that, because we spent some classes analysing that very closely and we're finished with the Schlietheim Confession. Now, Belgic Confession 36 says it refers to the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people and all who introduce a community of goods. Which raises the question, what groups do practice community of goods and or attack private property? We start with the Anabaptists themselves. The Anabaptists themselves. The Munster Rebellion in that city, 1534 to 1535, they practiced community of goods, and they practiced community of other things as well as goods. Any other Anabaptist groups?
Amish.
The Amish community of goods. The Hutterites, who've been at it for four centuries. And the Bruderhof. They're very prominent in website searches, at least the way my computer is set up. And I typed in community of goods. They came on and I watched a video by a girl who explained why she thinks community of goods is the way to go. It was kind of unusual for me to see on YouTube a video by a Bruderhof. I wouldn't have thought they would have done videos about the technology issue and so forth, but I find it very hard to work out what's in and what's out. Not every Anabaptist today or even in the 16th century believes, though, in community of goods. And the biggest, most famous group that doesn't believe in the community of goods is the Mennonites. I should also add that there are degrees of strictness within community of goods and forms. And I don't know this system from within, so I'm not going to be able to tell you which ones would do what and whatever circumstance, and for our present circumstances we don't need to know. Let's move on to the second group that practices community of goods. There are other groups, but I think you're going to say this one next, namely Just think of the word community of goods.
Communists.
The communists. The communists. Because it's a model community, and we have all things in common and community of goods. So when we're talking about the communists, we're thinking first of all of those nearest to us, the Eastern Bloc nations behind the Iron Curtain, including Hungary. Prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall on the 9th of November 1989. Can anyone remember where they were on the 9th of November 1989? This was a big moment in history. You know, it's one of those times like when JFK was shot. Not that I was around there to see that, but people could say, I can remember where I was. Right? So we have the Eastern Bloc nations, the Warsaw Pact nations. China, speaking about communist countries today, although all sorts of market reforms have gone on there. North Korea, communism is succeeding wonderfully there with its grinding poverty and people chewing grass from what we hear. Not that we're laughing at them, because that's an awful thing, but the theory and practice of communism are two very different things. Cuba and our own friend Fidel. Vietnam and Laos, who are struggling to hold on to communism, because the big problem with communism and why it falls is not even that the people get sick of totalitarianism, being told what to do, but eventually they run out of other people's money and the whole thing goes to the dogs. And the question is, how long can a communist state keep it up? Well, it depends how strong capitalism was and how wealthy they were for how long they can keep it going. So if you start out pretty poor, well, it'll go, and of course it also depends on how much the people are willing to put up with. So when we move to the communist language with regard to the community of goods, one thinks of phrases such as the means of production, factories and tools. The means of production need to be in the hands of the proletariat. The means of production, that's the making of the goods and the goods themselves, and is the fruits of these fruits of the production. Then comes the whole class struggle between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. The class struggle, the fist, we're going to fight. And now in the 21st century, we need to raise up as much class, as much struggle and hatred and antipathy between groups of religions and colours and genders and people who are homosexual as opposed to those who aren't. So that we can get this big maelstrom going and we can remake the world in a humanistic, anti-Christian form. And for the communist, private property is the evil. It's like the original sin doctrine for communism. Hillary?
I was going to say, there's also the propaganda. Because, you know, in communist Russia and all, you see all the big billboards with the... Yeah. And you get it in North Korea as well.
You do.
And all these communist countries with...
The cult of the leader.
Yes.
Yes. The cult of the leader. Yes, because it's so democratic and everybody is so equal that what we really need in an equal society is a huge poster with everybody praising one person. That's how you get equality.
The sun rising behind them.
Yes. And he might even have been lifting the sun with a hand behind his back. Yes. So we have the Anabaptists, or much of them. We have the communists, all of them. And if we move to the land of Israel, what group in Israel practices community of goods?
Kibbutzim.
The kibbutzim, yes. And some of you will know from your authorized version that the im at the end is Hebrew for the plural. So in English it's typically an S at the end, but in Hebrew it's im. Like the cherubim, or the cherubims, because they gave it a Hebrew plural and an English plural to make sure that everybody got it right. So the kibbutzim in Israel, the kibbutzim at the start were into farming and agriculture, and many of them still are, but there are actually technological kibbutzim where you have computer operators and engineers working together in community. And from the little I read in my research about it, some of these people have turned out to be very highly educated and skilled. So it wasn't that they had this little group and education failed by the wayside. There's many of them are actually well above standard, but then that's often the way with Israelis. Now, within Roman Catholicism, Where would you go for community of goods? Brian?
Convent.
The convent, yes. The convent for women, or the monastery for men. So we have now monasticism. So I'm just going to talk about Roman Catholic monasticism rather than Eastern Orthodox monasticism or monasticism of other Christian groups in the East, because that's more familiar to me and to you. Which of the three famous vows in Roman Catholic monasticism most pertains to the issue of the community of goods? There's the vow of poverty. The vow of poverty means basically no private property. But I always wonder about the toothbrush. You know, you can't really do a community of goods with your toothbrush. But anyway, of course, there are all sorts of ways around this. You know, like even with your wife, you don't want to share a toothbrush. There are some things that are just too private. So there's always that wee bit of a remnant of private property there, and the communists were never able to get that idea completely eliminated. The other vows, your vow of poverty, the other vows are the vows of chastity, which means celibacy, and the vow of
silence. That's
not within the whole lot, but some take the additional vow of silence, the vow of obedience. And the vow of obedience is the obedience to the superior. So no private property. And you can think here of medieval monasticism with communal eating at long tables, so that all the monks go out and work in the field. There are different forms of monasticism and noble, but let's keep it simple. All the monks go out and work in the field. They bring it in, there's a common pot, then it's cooked up and they all get to eat the same food, pretty much the same sorts of amounts. So community of goods. There's a community of production, everybody's working, and there's a community of consumption. Everybody eats more or less the same. As a fifth group, I'm going to mention the Jesus movement, or the Jesus people. The Jesus movement, or the Jesus people. And one of my favorite authors was caught up in the Jesus movement, Hughes Oliphant Old, who's got a great book on the history of preaching, and he was into the Jesus people. And the Jesus movement, consisting of Jesus people, started off in
United States.
It started off in the United States. And like many things that started off in the United States, they started off in California. In the early days of America, many things started in New England. And then as you moved forward, many more things started in California, including communism. They're pretty leftist sort of society. So, the Jesus movement. The Jesus movement, for as a simple way of getting it across, the Jesus movement consisted of what we would call Christian hippies. So think of hippies with a bit of Jesus in there. They started in the late 60s and onwards, and there was a utopianism about them, as there typically would be about a hippie. They were often left-wing and communistic, simplistic, biblicistic, and their reading of the Bible was really anti-theology, and they thought, hey, love, brother, love, share all our goods, and they set up communes. So this list isn't exhaustive. I picked five with which we are most familiar, I think, although the Jesus people may have been new to some of you. Can anyone remember the start of the Jesus people, or the early day? You can remember it, Brian?
Yeah, like I remember where it went to, how it went really crazy.
Do you want to tell us?
Not really.
Okay, yeah, so it did go a bit wacky. Yeah. It was pretty charismatic too. It's the usual sort of Anabaptist mixture, and millennialist as well. So, having identified these five groups, and I hope all or most of you are able to see them on the board, I want to analyze them now from this perspective. What about the role of religion among these groups? I mean by religion, not specifically biblical religion, but religion as it would be defined, let's say, on Wikipedia. What about the religion, the religious, the attitude towards religion. Let's start with number B, the second one here, the communists. You know, is the community of goods a religious thing, or is it not a religious thing? Or because if we go with the communism, communism is virulently anti-religion. Religion is the opiate of the people.
Are they though?
Ah, Sam's raising a second. Go ahead.
Well, like Hillary mentioned earlier, you know, very often these communists, they worship some state leader, and they're really anti other religions.
Yes. Yep. Yep. So there's a certain degree of ambiguity in the term religion. So it's anti-religion, but in a sense it is a religion, a replacement religion, which is quite an intolerant religion and attacks all the other forms of it. Karl Marx, another man we love to quote, Karl Marx said, "There is nothing more abominable than religion." And again, all worship of a divinity is a necrophilia. Nothing more abominable than religion. All religion is a necrophilia. Now, let's move to the kibbutzim. So the communists are radically anti-religion, defined not now the way Sam did it, lots of valid definition, but sort of in the general accepted form. You know, religions, there's Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism and Christianity. The kibbutzim, some of the kibbutzim, especially at the start, were into Judaism. But others at the start were secular, and now most kibbutzim are secular and a few are into Judaism. So the balance of power has shifted between the early to the late kibbutzim over the last century in Israeli, or in Israel. Christianity, moving to forms of Christianity, Anabaptism, much of it is into community of goods. One of the higher echelons of Roman Catholicism within their system, monasticism, community of goods, and the Jesus movement was a sort of part of charismatic evangelicalism. So is community of goods a religious phenomenon? Well, sometimes it's held by people with no religion, like the secular kibbutzim, a group of individuals. Sometimes it's held and practiced by those who are anti-religion, like the communists, not now a group of individuals, but the state and countries. And then there are various religions, the Jewish kibbutzim, or the Christian Anabaptists, or Roman Catholics with their monasticism, or evangelicals with the Jesus movement. And if we went through the other religions with which we're not quite as familiar, there would be some forms of community of goods there, especially within their monastic movements.
I mean, they're all kind of zealots in their own way. Like, you have to be really into it to make community of goods stick.
Okay. Yes. Yes, lukewarm people.
Like, think of wacko cults. You know, they're typically into this.
Yes. So, it's all zealots. Your average guy who's a little bit of religious, or a little bit of a secularist, or a little bit of an idealist, he's not going to go in. This is for the elite, the really devoted people. Yeah. Do you find yourself attracted to it, Tibor? No? Okay. Well, by the end of this class, you're going to be even less attracted toward it. Mary?
Well, the pilgrims tried it.
The pilgrims tried it. Oh, Mary's throwing a spanner into the wrench. The pilgrims tried it. Yeah, the pilgrims. Okay. Do you want to tell us a bit more?
Well, they tried it for a while when they first arrived.
In America?
In America, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
And gave up. Because it didn't work because nobody worked. Yeah. Everybody stopped working because, well, what was the point?
Yeah. Mary's referring to the pilgrim fathers who settled in New England and around Massachusetts Bay. From 1620 and onward, and they tried some form of community of goods. But again, you know, to go back to Sam's point, the pilgrims, well, not all of those people who landed were actually even professing Christians. You know, some of them were very ungodly people. But certainly the pilgrims were zealous. They were Congregationalists, by and large, and they were pretty hot Puritans. They were even hotter, this is the language of the time, than the average Presbyterian Puritan. Hotter and radical and zealous are sort of similar types of words. You could make it work, community of goods, if the people were really, really, really spiritual. And if the people loved each other and did not have old flesh to battle with. But then Mary mentioned that because, remember, we were talking about it fairly recently, that some of the leftists in America were saying, you know, look, communism's no new thing here, and progressivism. Our country started off that way. You know, here's some of the things that some of these guys said and did in the very, very early days. But then they don't tell you, yeah, that the whole thing collapsed. The people were starving, and they realized this experiment is not working. We need to get back to, you know, capitalism. And then they started growing, people started caring for their families, and the whole thing took off. But you should never let historical truth stand in the way of left-wing politics. Yeah. Another way of putting what Sam said with the zealot idea is these groups, what they have in common is, yes, they're zealous, and to make it even more pointed, they are all utopian. John Calvin was zealous. Agreed? I mean, he wasn't utopian. So the utopians are a subset of the zealots. So the people in these groups are all utopian. Some of them hold to a secular utopianism, the kibbutzim. You know, we'll have our own little group and we'll farm and we'll share things and we'll play our musical instruments and we'll bring up our children away from the modern rush of society. We'll have a simple time together and just care for one another in our group. So there's a secular utopianism. We're going to have an ideal society. And then there's an anti-religious secularism, which, as Sam said, is also quite religious. It's just a different sort of religion. Namely, communism. And then there is a religious utopianism. Monasticism, as close as you can get to heaven and this earth, because you're right there in the fervent service of the Pope. You've got a higher level of spirituality because you're really devoted to the Lord. You don't have to do normal work and mix with the less devoted Christians out there. And the Jesus people, they had discovered something really new and they wanted to share it and reach new levels of love and joy and unity and peace. So they're all utopian. And in general, utopianism has a shallow view of the problem, the human problem. You have to have, if you're ever going to believe that we can achieve utopia on earth. Like, as Christians, as Calvinists, when believing in the total depravity of man with original sin, we do not believe that we can reconstruct society to make it pretty wonderful, or even that we can make the church this absolutely amazing. But now, don't get me wrong, you're all wonderful people, you know, but we're never going to, I don't want anybody to think the CPRC, I mean, this is it, like we really have reached it, or give us next year and we'll be perfect. It doesn't, you know, we don't believe in sinless perfectionism of the individual. We don't believe in the perfection of society or a country, and we do not believe in the perfection of the church. And we have two elders in the room here, and any of you believe in the perfection of the church? No, I didn't think so. No. So there's a shallow view of the problem. Once you believe the problem is sin, that sin is in human beings through our fall in Adam, and that even God's purpose of redemption and grace in Jesus Christ, we only have a small beginning of the new obedience, and it comes in the new heavens and the new earth. That's perfection. Utopianism always seems to a thinking, clear-headed, Reformed Christian as arrant nonsense and incredibly dangerous. I'm in my middle 40s, but when I hear, you know, left-wing politicians and they're going to make the world, I immediately think, if they get in with their views, they are going to make this world far worse than it's got to be. And the more they talk about this wonderful world they're going to create, the more I think, especially from the scriptures and even from ordinary history, the more I think, I wonder how many people are going to lose their livelihoods out of this. How many businesses are going to be shut down? If they really get this going, how many people are going to be liquidated? And the shallow evaluation of the problem is, the problem is private property. The problem is materialism. The problem is human greed and covetousness. If we could just get rid of private property, people wouldn't be greedy, there wouldn't be this fighting between the classes, everybody would have the same amount, and it would all be good. I can't help but interject in here some of the comments that I read regarding the people in the kibbutzim with their children. Here are these adults, and they're practicing the community of goods, and then they've got these children, and the children are playing the "it's mine" game. And they start fighting. And you have all these really idealistic, zealot, utopian kibbutzim people. And then their children are pulling things off others in the playground and so forth. And they're wondering, what's happening here? We didn't expect that. We didn't read that in our books. It wasn't meant to happen this way. And you think, yeah, but get into the real world, people. You know, the real world. And your children are smarter than you are. Not that I'm saying they should be selfish. They're totally depraved. But at least they realize, private property isn't the problem. The problem, of course, is that he has more bricks than I do. Yeah. So, private property is the problem, which leads to materialism and greed. Of course, what they should say is, the problem is greed, original sin. But, well, that's the way it goes. So, let's analyze the community of goods, this zealous utopian worldview, in Christian theological terms. In the field of anthropology, the key issue, and think of all the things that fall under the doctrine of man, the key issue is, as I've been saying, original sin. They're hopelessly lost in the area of original sin. It's private property. That's the problem, not man's heart. In ecclesiology, what they're after is the ideal community. They're like Christians who are looking for the perfect church. They're going to create this community which is going to be just heaven on earth. But if you're a communist, it's you can't use that phrase, but you have to come up with something else. So we're looking for the ideal community. The Roman Catholic monastery, or the Anabaptist commune, or the kibbutz, or the Jesus people hanging out together, playing and making music. And then if we move to eschatology, there's especially one of these groups which is particularly good to analyze from this point of view, eschatology, that were the end times. You have a 1 in 5 chance. Sorry? Anabaptists. The Anabaptists would probably be the number 2. For instance, like Munster, they were going to bring in the new heavens and new earth, but that would only be one part of Anabaptists, and they were millennialists. But the group for whom eschatology or end times is most supportive of their form of community of goods is actually the communists. The communists. The communists have an eschatology. The idea was, and now we're almost back to the Cold War, and we're back to Korea and Vietnam with the wars, with the American involvement. The domino theory. Remember the domino theory? The communists, let's put ourselves, we'll say, after World War II, the communists, they've got China, more or less. They haven't got Taiwan, but they've got China. And they've got Russia, which is the biggest country in the world. And they've got Central and Eastern Europe. And they're seeking to take over the world. The Communist International. It were going to be a global movement. And so places like Mongolia, which weren't too powerful, well, they're going to be influenced by both the Russians and the Chinese. And then you have somewhere like Korea, which is sort of between Russia and China. So there's a big battle there. And then Vietnam, south of China, and the whole of Indochina. And then they tried to push it in Indonesia and in parts of Africa and South America. And the idea is, we're going to take over the world. So we've got these countries, and the American response in the rest of the world was, what was familiar to was the domino. You know, if we let them take Korea or Japan, then they'll just keep on marching. So we have to send in troops. So we take over these countries, and the goal is we can make the whole world, because communism is an international movement, it's very obviously international, we'll take over the whole world, and then we will reach utopia with the global classless society. We'll make each country that we take over more and more communist, and then we'll make more countries communist, and bit by bit we'll have the classless society, so there'll be no conflict over private property, and so there'll be no conflict between the classes, and we will have heaven on earth, or whatever phrase Lenin and Stalin and so. Utopia. Utopia. So you could say that the Anabaptists, they want a utopia in their own little society and forget about the world. And the communists, they want a utopia for everybody because they're really generous and selfless. We don't want to just have it for ourselves. We want everybody else to have it too. And we're willing to put a gun to their head so that they will enjoy it. And we're willing to put in armies because this new world is so good that it's worth fighting for. So to go back to what Sam said, you could say that the community of goods is a religious phenomenon, despite the fact that it's held by some people who have no religion, and other people who are anti-religion, and by people of various religions. Community of goods is a sort of religious phenomenon because there's zealotry there and it's utopianism, but it is certainly an element in bad religion. Now, religion understood very badly. And when you get religion understood very badly, you often get this community of goods idea. Any thoughts on this so far? Because it's a bit of a natural break. Is everybody with me so far? Yeah. I should say that we're laying the groundwork. Next week is going to be more biblical. There is some Bible coming up, don't worry. But we need to explain the nature of the beast. We need to know what we're dealing with before we analyze it and critique it scripturally. Sam?
Why is it that, you know, when these religions get like so bad, I mean, these are examples of some of the worst kinds of things ever, and community of goods becomes a thing for them.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know, you think of some of these really, really out there cults, and they go into the community of goods. Like, is it because they're denying all the very basic things about creation?
Yes, I think it's zealous, we're really into it, it's utopian, we're really into it, and we can make a difference in making this brilliant world. But then it's, what was the other thing you mentioned towards the end there?
Like denying the basics of creation?
It's whenever someone gets really zealous and utopian, they lose touch of reality. The average person on the street is never going to buy into the community of goods. In fact, the average person on the street, this is the problem that the communists have, the average person on the street, 90% of the average people on the street, is never even going to imagine community of goods. Because I look around this room, I would say this room is filled with bourgeois people. It's a bunch of bourgeois people. Lily, you're on my left-hand side, so I'm not looking at the middle. Have you ever dreamt that the world would be a better place if we could just put all our goods together and just share it out evenly? Did that idea ever enter your head? No. And even, that never entered your head at all. You know, and that's why you see Karl Marx, those guys came along and said, what we need to do is educate people. We need to raise class consciousness. We need to take the poor people, tell them how bad they are, make them feel really, really left out and angry. Mobilize them, get the activists out there, stir them up, have a rebellion, and then we can share out all the goods. Brian?
Yeah, the other thing about communism is that you end up with a two-tier society. You have the ones at the top who are absolutely super rich, mm-hmm. and everyone else is just slaves.
Yes. Communism does not achieve a classless society. It destroys the middle class, and it elevates a number of people. And the majority of the people become poorer than what they ever were. That is, if you give it enough time. And not that Venezuela is a full communist state, but even the lesser forms of it, the country's gone from basically the wealthiest in South America to the poorest in South America in a very few short years, even though it has the largest reserves of oil in the world.
And Cuba. Because you have the hierarchy in Cuba who lives on an island off the island.
Yes. But the Cubans have a good universal health care. The Cubans have education for all. Yeah, but what are they teaching them? And what level is this health care? Yeah. Now, of course, we've some contacts from Cuba over the years and sent them different things, and they really struggle.
In a sense, it's denying God's sovereignty, because God has not made us all equal.
No. God has not made us all equal. Election and reprobation. Creation of one man as a king. God raised up wicked Nebuchadnezzar. You see, the equality, the justice, the leveling is going to take place at the great white throne of Jesus Christ, and then everybody will be rewarded for their works, and God will do it. And the problem with the community of goods, especially as it's in the communist form, is the state and the philosophers, they play God. They're not living in the real world at all. Now, let's explain and answer some questions regarding the community of goods that have arisen historically and inevitably arise. The fourth paragraph of Belgic Confession 36 talks about those who, quote, introduce a community of goods. The finger is on the introduction of the community of goods. Those are the problems of the community of goods, but there's introducing it. Which, of course, brings up the issue of how is it introduced? And the various forms, the seditious people, the Anabaptists, and all who reject the higher powers. Is it introduced, one could ask, with or without force? Or, which is often just as powerful as force, the threat of force? Let's think, obviously, of communism. Communism. So we have Russia. In 1917, in the middle of the First World War and onwards, communism was introduced by means of a civil war with all sorts of factions. The Reds versus the Whites, to simplify things. And of course, the Reds, Mary, were the communists. Yes. To quote Lenin once again, if for the sake of communism, it is necessary for us to destroy 9/10 of the people, comma, we must not hesitate. I mean, he didn't say we mustn't draw back. He said we mustn't even hesitate. We've got 9/10 of the people, and that's what's necessary for achieving communism. We don't even pause. Lenin in 1921. And then Eastern Europe became communist, and Central Europe too, parts of it, Tibor, with Russian intimidation after World War II. There were no civil wars there because the Red Army's tanks were parked in the streets. And, you know, you guys are going now to make these communist leaders the heads of the states. Now, aren't you? Yes. China had a long-running civil war between Mao's communist forces and the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek. And then, of course, we have in Korea the civil war, Laos the civil war, Cuba, Vietnam. So then there were all these countries with the goal of taking over the world. So there was force. So this one here has been introduced by force. And then when it was introduced, of course, was the force used against its own citizens who weren't communist enough, and the purges, meaning tens of millions of people died. And then when things didn't work out, the communist leaders, instead of saying, the problem is that our theory's wrong, this doesn't work in the real world, the problem is the people who aren't sufficiently communist, we need to purge them, and the more people we kill, the better our communism will become when we get closer to this class, the society. Within Anabaptism, where especially was the class, was the community of goods introduced with force? Think back to what we said earlier. The Munster Rebellion. And there it wasn't a country, as with the communist countries. It was a city. It was a city. And then from that city, a bit like the atheistic communists, it was intended to spread outwards into the Netherlands and other parts of Germany, and so forth. The Belgic Confession: we detest the error of the Anabaptists who introduce a community of goods and would introduce it further. We detest the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people, and in general all those who reject the higher powers and magistrates and would subvert justice, introduce a community of goods, and confound that decency and good order which God hath established among men. That goes back to what you were saying earlier, Julian. This is just an unreal, unreal view. It doesn't fit with what we've got in this creation. Now, others have and would introduce the community of goods without force. Most Anabaptists, they introduced the community of goods without force and among themselves. The kibbutzim, now someone could talk about Israeli violence and in the land of Palestine and so forth, but the kibbutzim, they set it up of themselves. Roman Catholic monasticism and the Jesus movement, that wasn't with force. Then there's the question of whose decision is it to introduce it? Who sets up the community, the regime with community of goods? Well, if it's a country, the communists set it up in various countries because they became the dominant group. With regard to a city, I'm just restating earlier material in a slightly different way, the Munster Anabaptists set it up. The commune, they set it up. But in those countries and in that city I mentioned, there were a lot of people who disagreed. Now, when the commune is set up, whether it's a country or a city or a group of people, when other people join it, would you say they join it willingly or unwillingly? The community has been set up. Think of, let's say, Russia or a kibbutzim or an Anabaptist commune. People who come in from the outside. But in general, once a commune is set up, the people who join it willingly, even gladly. They think this is it. Like, for instance, there are many leftist English intellectuals who moved to Russia or the USSR. Of course, the Soviets didn't really want them over there because they just have to feed them and so forth, and then they had difficulty settling them into a Russian way of life and dealing with the cold winters and so forth. And they were actually more useful to the USSR, spreading propaganda for communism in the British Isles, but they could hardly turn them away. But can you think of someone who was brought to a society which practiced the community of goods who didn't want to go? A little boy in Saxony in the days of medieval monasticism, and who tried to get out of it once he grew up a bit and realized, or at least Gottschalk. But then he was a boy and he was brought by his father, you know, so then the willingness comes in, you know, he's a minor number one, he's brought by his father. But most people who join it, you know, today do so willingly. Now, let's go back to this issue, community of goods. What is common in community of goods? Well, obviously, goods, property. And the next thing, if you think about it, what's common in a society where community of goods is practiced is decision making. You know, if people are going to share all their goods, here's all my money, and we're going to pool it and divide it up equally, then we're all going to make decisions together, one would think. But then we go back to something that was said earlier about the communist states, that the leaders end up, and the common man has fewer and fewer decisions to make about even his own life. And there's a pretended democracy. And so you have with communism, as has been famously remarked, one man, one vote, one time. And you end up, especially as the system goes along and you need to control the media and churn out the propaganda, you end up with tyranny and the vast wealth of the leaders like Stalin, Nicolae Ceausescu, and the vast palace that he had in Romania, which is the heaviest building in the world, and which is the second largest building in the world, only behind the Pentagon, which costs about $6 million a year to heat. And they've got this huge white elephant now. What do we do with this? This guy built for himself. And then you have the secret police. So you would expect common decision making, but in communism you don't get that. The state. In Anabaptist Munster, the city leaders, including John of Leiden, lay down the law. In Roman Catholic monasticism, remember the one of the vows we talked about? Common property, community of goods. But one of the vows is the vow of obedience. So you have sworn to do whatever the abbot or the abbess says. So that's not very common decision making. But other groups, like with the Jesus people or the Kibbutzim, or sometimes in Anabaptism, you know, you do have common decision making more along the lines of an extreme form of, let's say, congregationalism, the congregational meeting where everybody gets one vote on all issues. Sam?
Or just lack of decision making.
Or lack of decision. Have you had times in your life where you've been somewhere where lack of decision making was the problem? Because you spoke that as if as if you spoke by experience. Yes. Yes. It can be very infuriating, can't it? Yeah. But within Anabaptism, the other extreme is that there's typically one elder who tends to rule. And it's interesting that the very first community of goods Anabaptist group had a leader called Jacob Wiedema. And he had one eye. And his government, which could of course happen to anybody, but it's an interesting fact, he had one eye. And his government of that very first group of Anabaptists, the Praggis Community of Goods, was, even according to Anabaptist historians, very, very high-handed. And it was interesting to me when I was reading about this that it took place, the very first Anabaptist group was set up at Austerlitz. Austerlitz. Anybody? Tibor, Austerlitz, ring any bells? Austerlitz was the scene of a famous battle where Napoleon the First beat this much larger Russian and Austrian army. The battle of sort of three emperors sort of thing. So it was at Austerlitz. So we have what's in common, well, the goods are, and then decision making ought to be, but often isn't, and you actually end up with more tyranny and high-handedness than even in societies which practice private property. That awful, horrible disease. Now, the next thing you end up with, for some of the groups, it's a logical idea, if property is common and decision-making ought to be common, you've got a group, people are all living together, the property's common. What's the next thing somebody's going to say ought to be common?
The females in the community.
Females in the community. Now, we're not saying that every group that is communist or that believes in the community goods does this. We're emphatically not saying this. But this is where some of them end up. This is what happened at Munster. They brought in community of goods, and the next thing you know, it was community of wives. And guess who got the most wives? Which people got the most? The leaders. So Bernard Rothman, who left the Lutheran faith, he had 9 wives. And of course you wonder, if we have a community of goods, a community of wives, how does he get 9? You know, and did the ordinary guy get 9? And, you know, so, and let's go to Jacob Wiedemann at Austerlitz. He commanded, this is part of his tyranny, he commanded single women to marry men they didn't love or didn't want to marry. Otherwise, he said, look, if you don't marry those men, I'm going to secure heathen women to marry the single men of the group. And you think to yourself, I thought these people were supposed to be biblical. He's threatening the women in the group, but if they don't do what he's told and marry men and they don't want to marry, that he will bring in heathen women I wonder what the heathen women thought of this. He'd bring in heathen women, that is, including Reformed people and Roman Catholics, that's how they were viewed as heathen, to marry the men of the group. And let me introduce another commune that I haven't mentioned here because it's an isolated group. It wasn't part of a massive movement. But I'll bring it up now, though. Horatio Spafford. Horatio Spafford, who wrote the well-known hymn with the chorus, "It is well with my soul." Well, Horatio Spafford and his wife and the overcomers who came from Chicago set up a commune practicing community of goods in Jerusalem. And again, it was Zionist pre-millennial ideas. It's going to be a Jewish, Christ is going to come back, date setting, and he's going to come back to the Mount of Olives, and they actually set the date, and they were going to be there because they were going to be taken up there to meet with him. But Horatio Spafford got a revelation from God telling him that everybody in the group had to be celibate. And you say, "Hold, how does this get to the community of communion of wives?" Well, we'll come on there. Everybody had to be celibate. And the argument for this is, with zealous, utopian, millennialistic groups, heaven is just about to come, you see, and there's no marriage in heaven. So if we want to anticipate heaven and get there, we have to scrap marriage. Which means then, you know, take off your wedding ring, which they did, and of course then sell it, and then put it into the common pot. You know, because we're practicing community of goods. So he said, and of course this didn't go down terribly well, and people began to wonder, was God really saying this when 1 Timothy 4 verses 1 through 3 has the Holy Spirit saying that in the last days there'll be evil spirits and seduce people, forbidding to marry. So anyway, and then his wife Anna, she said that there's this community here, and we're not to have marriage and no sexual intercourse, but we're really holy, you see, we're almost in heaven. So she then designated a man and a woman and said, "You two have to go to bed together, but you're not allowed to touch each other. And this is going to show how holy you are, because you'll be able to overcome this temptation." Of course, Jesus said, "Lead us not into temptation." That's what he taught us to pray. And then, of course, there was adultery and fornication and so forth. And that's another way in which the sharing can come, and the authoritarianism of the leader. And now, what's the next thing you think that's likely to be shared and become common? What logically follows from number three?
Children.
Children. Children. You know, because after all, you know, you see, property, the problem with private property is the word my toothbrush, my school bag, my clothes, and then it's my wife, and the next thing it's my children or our children. So the children, they had this in the kibbutzim, many of them. So the children would be schooled and they would sleep communally, not with their parents, but in some big dormitory with one or two adults, let's say, looking after them. And they would only spend a short time with their parents each day, because the children belong to the community, not their parents, because you got to break up the family.
The Nazis kind of tried to do this, but didn't they? I mean, the Nazis weren't exactly communists, but they were when it suited them.
Aye, they wanted to make people loyal to the Führer and so forth. That was probably their goal, and with the Hitler Youth, that type of thing, or maybe the Hitler Infantheim.
They took people away, like, for these breeding experiments.
Okay, yes.
And then the children were sort of like nobody's children. They were like the state's children.
The state's children, yes. It takes a village after all. You know, your children aren't really your children. And your business really isn't your business. It's really the community runs your business. Here's the Hutterite, the Anabaptist group. The children attended school in the Hutterite community at the age of two. Started to attend school at the age of two, that number one. And they attended all day, number two, the year round. And then about 5 or 6 years, they were transferred from that nursery school that they attended all day from the age of 2 onward, all year round, to work under a schoolmaster. And so it went. And you wonder, now if they're at the age of 2 all day, all the year round, when did they get to see their parents? Because, see, common property, my sofa, my house, common wives, common children. We want to get rid of the my. In going back to Horatio Spafford and his commune with common property in Jerusalem, children were forcibly taken away from their parents to sleep in rooms with unmarried women. So you can imagine, what's going to happen there? What's going to happen once you take the children away from their parents? Tears. They're all going to be crying, the children especially. They're going to be taken away. And of course, this sort of thing goes all the way back to Plato, in Plato's Republic, in which he sets forth sort of the philosopher king and the model state. And the model state has children being taken away from their parents to be brought up by the state. And there's a lot of people in our Western world who think along these lines, who think that the way to bring up better children is to give the parents less and less influence over their children, and the state, through the state education, more and more influence over the children. Because what's supposed is that the parents are a bad influence and the state is a good influence. And of course, Sparta did this. They took the children away from their parents to make them really tough so that they would be superb fighters. Now, a couple more sections. This is the penultimate one. Let's turn to Psalm 128. Psalm 128. We read it earlier. Notice in this psalm, you eat your own labor. Verse 2, thou shalt eat the labor of thine hands, not your neighbor, not the commune, not the civil government. You eat the labor of your own hands. And the idea is that you do the work and you possess the fruit and you eat it. So there's the means of production, yourself, and the consumption of it, yourself. Then it says, guess where your wife is. Verse 3, she's a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house. So you own your house or you rent your house, but it's very clearly your house. And she's there in your house and you're there with her in the house that the two of you own together. You're not in your community. You eat your own labor and you have your own wife. And then the next verse, later in that verse, your children are in your own house. And isn't that the best place for them? In your own house. There they are like olive trees round about your own table. They're not in some dormitory being kept by communal guardians. So you're eating your own labors, you have your own wife and you have your own children and you have your own table, and your table doesn't belong to the state and it doesn't belong to your next door neighbor, and your wife certainly doesn't belong to the state or your husband, to your next door neighbor. And then the church, it's mentioned in verse 5, the Lord shall bless thee out of Zion, and thou shalt see the good of Jerusalem all the days of thy life. The church is a different place from your home. Now, none of us, in looking at Psalm 128, ever paused to give these things a thought, because it's so obvious. But now, after looking at community of goods and the crazy notions up on the blackboard, or whiteboard, I should say, you begin to see how radical the Bible is. How radical that the church is a different place from your home. And you've got their home, and that's where you and your wife and your children are. You have your own table, and you eat the food that you've worked for. And then you go to church. It's a different place. Yeah. And what we have here in Psalm 128 is normalcy, the way God intends it for his people. We have right relationships here for the man who is blessed, as verse 1 and 4 and 5 says, as the man who is God-fearing. The God-fearing and blessed man is in proper structural relationships. He has a family in the family home with his wife and children. And there's work that goes on to supply and nurture them. And there is the church. Isn't that a radical vision? That's the Christian manifesto. 1849, or rather, whatever David happened to pen, or whoever penned Psalm 128.
These folk could come back at you with Acts 2, 42, 44.
Thank you, Julian. I mean it. Thank you. Because the second thing and final thing out of these last two things, we have more to say on community of goods. Tonight has been the introduction, laying out the nature of the beast, to use the words you used earlier. Next week, we're going to develop our subject. And the present intention is it will include the appeal of Christian community of goods, because we ought to understand that there is something there. You know, you can say that does in a sense sound nice. We would all like a deeper, more intimate church fellowship and a better world and so forth. There is an appeal to it. And then we're going to look at Scripture. We're going to look at the arguments that they use citing Scripture, including the one Julian just referred to in Acts chapter 2. And we are not going to flinch and say, well, you know, we've a guilty conscience. There's one or two verses in the Bible that favor the community of goods, and we're kind of stumped, but we'll just brush them under the table. We're going to see that they emphatically do not mean what they think they mean. And in fact, when you read them with any degree of intelligence, as you ought to read the Scripture by the Spirit, you'll realize that they actually teach the exact opposite. And in this connection, we're going to look at the Christian view of property, and even prosperity, perhaps, if we get to that. Property, what are we to think about property, and how we are to use property. Because it's not enough to say that the community of goods isn't the right way. We need to see what the right way is for ourselves.